Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Nearly every single opinion poll conducted on religion in the United States will tell you that Americans are a deeply spiritual people. Compared to other Western European nations, folks living in the U.S. tend to report reasonably high levels of church attendance, high rates of personal prayer, and most of all, nearly all Americans profess a belief in God. Most surveys put the percentage of individuals believing in some supernatural being well above 90%. But what do Americans believe about God? Is there a standard vision of God's nature that all Americans share? Or do we differ in our beliefs? And do such differences have significant consequences for how we organize the rest of our daily lives? To help answer these questions, I am pleased today to be joined by Professor Paul Froese. Paul is an associate professor of sociology at Baylor University and a research fellow at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion. He is the author of The Plot to Kill God, Findings from the Soviet Experiment in Secularization, and a recently published work that is the topic of today's podcast entitled America's Four Gods, What We Say About God and What That Says About Us, from Oxford University Press. This latter book was co-authored with his Baylor colleague Chris Bader, who appeared on a show a few months back speaking about the belief in the paranormal. Professor Froese and Bader's book also has received quite a bit of favorable publicity, recently appearing in a front-page story in USA Today. But most importantly, I should note that Paul earned his PhD at the University of Washington, where he had a very distinguished committee mentoring him. So, Paul, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, hey, let's get down to brass tacks here. You graduated from the University of Washington, and the Huskies are going to the 2010 Holiday Bowl. So what's the deal? Are the Huskies going to beat Nebraska or what?
Well, you know, as an alum and as your former advisee, I have to be loyal and go with the Huskies.
And I've
never even, I guess I've driven through Nebraska, but that's really my only tie there. So definitely the Huskies.
That's a Big 12 school, and Baylor's in the Big 12, which is rapidly becoming the Big 4 or something like that.
So. Yeah, exactly.
And I just for our listeners, we won't tell Paul this, but this podcast is being recorded December 15th, and it actually is going to air after the Holiday Bowl, so we'll be able to test how well his prediction is. So don't tell him.
Well, the social scientists, they want to predict things, so we'll see.
Oh, I didn't cut your microphone off. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, we'll find out, and we'll see what happens in the 2010 Holiday Bowl. But in a more serious vein, let's talk about your new book. As I mentioned, it was co-authored with Chris Bader, and it's called America's Four Gods. And that title might seem a little bit odd for some folks, since most people would agree that America is predominantly a Christian nation, so we would expect that we'd all be worshiping one God, and that being the Christian conception of God. But as your book points out, there are really some significant different concepts of how we view God among Christians here in the United States. In fact, as the title suggests, you find four major conceptualizations of God, and you could actually make it five if you throw in atheism to that mix. But before we reveal what these different ideas of God are, I think it would be useful to start by asking why such differences in how we conceive of God is important. You do a nice job of that in the beginning of the book. So what's the deal here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the genesis of the idea behind the book was we were interested in how people constitute their worldviews. And I think in traditional sociology, we tend to think that a person's worldview is really a product of socialization. So, for instance, your parents might help determine what your particular interests are. Your friends might help shape your social skills, and your teachers might tell you what to think about history, or your preacher might tell you what to think about the Bible. And all of those different sources then give you different ideas that we say add up to your worldview. But because they were socialized, sociologists tend to think there's really no logical connection between the two. They're you're just kind of picking these things up.
Right.
But I think we know that people do ponder these things, and if there are some sort of inconsistencies, they try to resolve them. And so when thinking about this book, we start to think about what is it that maybe ties all the different beliefs and ideas people have in their worldview together. Is there some sort of logical core or foundational idea?
Mm-hmm.
And that really led us to think about the concept of God, because most Americans believe in God, and it seems to be a foundational belief, right? It's kind of about the structure or the meaning or the origins of the universe.
You do. You make a good case for that in the book, that how we view these basic fundamental questions about who we are, where we came from, the supernatural, and what effect it has in our daily lives affects everything else, or affects at least a lot of our other thinking in different realms such as politics, economics, in daily interactions with other human beings.
Exactly. And so the idea really is for the individual, if they're trying to make sense of, let's say, a certain political attitude they have, or make sense of a kind of a moral problem that they're engaged in, they'll probably think back to God, or, you know, a lot of people obviously pray and ask God specific questions. But the idea is that somewhere kind of deep in people's psyches are these images of God, beliefs about God that were established very early on in their lives. And that's kind of what gets referenced a lot when they're going through their lives.
I think that's an excellent point, because many political scientists I know in my field and sociologists in your field tend to overlook that fact that religion is something that you only do on Sunday. Most people don't really think about it much in their lives. And, you know, many of the faculty around the country that are studying other social problems and political problems really are not religious themselves, so don't have that reference to go back to, whereas most people do.
Mm-hmm. I guess he's a neurologist, Andrew Newberg, and he's done some research, and he suggests that certain images of God tend to get established in childhood, and they are so profound and so important that they actually help to shape how your brain forms throughout adolescence, which is kind of an interesting concept. I mean, I can't speak to the validity of that research, but it jives true to what we're finding about God.
And it fits with, you know, socialization literature, you know, melding with biology in some regards. It's interesting. We've tried to get Andrew Newberg on the show before, and we're going to keep working on it, but he's a pretty busy guy, so we'll keep,
okay,
keep
good,
after
good.
Your book, again, is a detailed examination of how people in the U.S. view God and what consequences those views have on other aspects of life, as we were just talking about here. And before revealing what these four concepts of God are, which are really the core of your book, how did you go about determining how people think about God? This gets us into the methodology of this a little bit, and for some people that might turn them off and be a little bit boring, but I think it's pretty important for you to detail at least how you get to know what people are thinking about when it comes to God.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting because people talk about God all the time, especially just in daily conversation, but we tend not to really think about what that word means to them. And so we were given the opportunity to do some national surveys of the American public, and with that opportunity we thought, well, it'd be interesting to just to start to query people on how they define that word God.
Mm-hmm.
And so the surveys were the Baylor Religion Surveys, and so far two waves have been conducted. And they are nationally representative surveys. And on these surveys, we had the opportunity to put a whole host of questions about God. I think probably on the first wave, we had upwards to 40 questions about God. And these are questions like, you know, do you think of God as a father? Do you think of God as a he? To what extent is God directly involved in your affairs? You know, a whole series of questions. And then we looked at the results and to see if there were any, how the questions kind of hung together. We did a factor analysis, which shows our answers to questions related to each other. And we found essentially two dimensions that came about.
Mm-hmm.
One dimension is the extent to which God is involved in people's lives. And the other dimension is the extent to which people think of God as wrathful or judgmental. And then, after doing those surveys and kind of having that finding, we went out and did a series of in-depth interviews with people around the country. In total, we did 106 interviews. And we kind of asked similar questions, but we're in interview format. We allowed people to kind of talk more about their experience with God and explain and describe God in much more detail. And so in that sense, we got to see how people's stories about God matched our survey data.
Yeah, it's a great blend of both quantitative survey research, where you're calling people up on the phone and they're answering a 40-question survey with five answers or something like that, and the qualitative aspect where people really can flesh this issue out. And so I recommend this book to a lot of folks out there, because the questions that they do ask on the Baylor survey are much different than the ones you get in most other surveys. Most other sociological surveys will ask a few questions on religion. It usually boils down to, do you believe in God? And that has the presupposition underlying it that we all have the same conception of God. And you're really fleshing that out here.
Mm-hmm.
And I should also note, too, that your book has a website associated with it. It's called www.americasforgods.com, and we'll link up to that on our website here. And listeners can go and actually take the survey or part of the survey that indicates what dimensions you fall on and how your views of God are. And maybe a little bit later on, I will reveal how I did on that survey.
Oh, cool.
It also did another thing I thought was really interesting in this, and I don't know if you did this in the initial study, but on that website, it has a series of pictures of God, how it's been depicted in paintings and artwork or other conceptualizations of God. And you go through there and you rank, does this fit your image of God or not? And I thought that was a really fun thing to do too. So
I know that, I think that's a really neat thing about the website. We initially started doing that in our interviews, and it, to be honest, it just became too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe this is kind of a follow-up project, but we did decide to keep that on the website, because then we could get a lot of people's responses to those images and maybe even do something with that data.
It is. It's really neat. And again, I'm going to point people in that direction and to go to that. We'll link up on our website and take the survey. See where you fall on these dimensions, because it will be in many ways somewhat surprising to you, I think. Okay, so here we are at the big payoff. You claim to have identified four distinct conceptualizations of God that different groups of Americans hold. So you mentioned already that there are these two dimensions where you can sort them out on. One is the involvement or engagement of God in day-to-day life. The other is the judgmental aspect, whether God is judging us on a daily basis for the things we do, or if the God that people conceive of says, no, I'm just letting it run, and you know, maybe we'll talk about it in the afterlife, or just let it run altogether. So tell us about each of these four different gods, and maybe start with it by going to the most prevalent group that we see here in America.
Sure. You know, before I go into four types, I just kind of want to make clear that these are ideal types. So they don't, in some sense, this is artificial. And what I mean by that is that what the data reveals to us is a continuum on both of these dimensions. So you can think of this as many, many different data points stretching from somebody who thinks of God as extremely judgmental to somebody who thinks of God as not judgmental at all.
Mm-hmm.
On that one dimension.
Right.
Or on the other dimensions, people who think of God as extremely engaged to not engaged at all. And so there are multiple places you could land on that continuum. So in dividing, kind of cutting those two dimensions, what we did was we overlaid them. So we said, okay, do you think of God how do you think of God's engagement? How do you think of God's judgment? And so you could either be high on both, low on both, high on one and low on the other, and high on the other and low on the first.
Right.
So that's where the four ideal types come.
And it creates a nice 2x2 matrix.
Exactly, a 2x2 matrix. So it works statistically, and it's related to a bunch of things. But if somebody wants to say, well, I don't quite fit into these four types, that's completely legitimate.
Yeah.
Because this is really just kind of manipulating the data in terms to get these four different dimensions. So let me explain what they are.
Okay.
So we very kind of cutely labeled them A, B, C, and D.
I did not notice that, and I'm looking at your website right now, and I see that.
Yeah. And so the first is authoritative God. Mm-hmm. And so these are people who believe that God is both very high in terms of engagement in the world and very high on judgment. So this is the engaged, judgmental God. And this is what most people in the United States believe. I don't have the number in front of me. I think it's around 30%.
I think you have it about 26. I'm looking at it right here. Oh, you're right, 31%. 31% of Americans believe in an authoritative God.
Authoritative God. The next one, B, is the benevolent God. And so it's similar to the authoritative God in that this God represents a very engaged God. But it differs from the authoritative God in that the benevolent God is not very judgmental. So these are people who think of God as doing a lot in the world, but only doing good, not being wrathful, not punishing or anything like this. And approximately 23% of Americans have this type of God, the benevolent God.
Mm-hmm.
The C is the critical God. And so these are people who don't think God is very engaged in the world, but still very judgmental. This, to be honest, was kind of a confusing type. And we struggled hard to make sense of this and find people who really could express this. But essentially what I think it boils down to are people who think God is really taking notes and in the afterlife will be highly judgmental. But in terms of guiding behavior or changing patterns in this world, God's not doing much. And approximately 16% of Americans have this image of God, the critical God.
Right.
And finally, D, the distant God, these are people who don't think of God as engaged or judgmental. And so you could think of this as more of a kind of a distant force or a cosmic force, or some of these people even thought of God as the Big Bang. And approximately 24-25% of Americans believe this. And then finally, you do have atheists. And in our survey data, we say they're about 5% of the population. And this can differ depending on the survey you're looking at.
Right.
And just to be fully forthright, a lot of people that might get defined as agnostics on other surveys tended to end up in our distant God category. And the reason for this is people who self-identify as agnostics, often if you press them a little bit, they do have certain supernatural beliefs. They just don't tend to think of God in such a kind of a concrete, image of a person. So we're kind of saying some of those people could be classified as believers in a distant God.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make, because there's been a number of other surveys that have come out talking about American nones, which is spelled N-O-N-E-S, where mm-hmm. people don't profess any affiliation or allegiance to religion in general. And the numbers of nuns is often cited at around 12-15%. And I'm thinking about the ERA study, the American Religion Identification Survey.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look carefully at that nuns, a lot of people will first assume, oh, those are atheists. But again, when you explore deeper down into this, and the folks who run the ERA study do delve deeper into this, they find that these people, as you mentioned, do have a concept of the supernatural, believe in the supernatural, but it's very fuzzy, vague, a distant God that's not interactive in daily life, and so they don't think about it much.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we found in our survey data, is that people who say they're spiritual but not religious,
mm-hmm.
people who tend not to affiliate with a religious group, they are these kind of believers in a distant God. Now, that said, some believers in a distant God could be very active church members also. So it kind of spans. And I think maybe that's another important point, is that these different beliefs about God, these kind of four different categories that we have, they correlate with stuff like church attendance and what kind of church you go to, but it's never perfect. So that you could have somebody who looks very like a very conservative evangelical in terms of their affiliation and their church attendance, but they could believe in a distant God.
Yeah, that's one of the things I actually found fascinating about your book. And let's move into this right now, talking about some of the socio-demographic characteristics that are associated or affiliated with each of these four different types of God. The first you talk about, or you talk about a number of different things here, is denominational affiliation. Mm-hmm. How are, say, evangelical Christians affiliated with one of these four types as compared to your Presbyterian believer?
Yes. I mean, the trends are going to kind of fall out as somebody might expect, and that is for people who are categorized as evangelical Protestants, and we could talk about how that categorization happens, but for those people, most of them are believers in authoritative God, which somebody might guess, right?
Right.
They're in a seemingly a conservative religion, and so they have a very kind of concrete image of a God who is highly engaged and pretty judgmental, especially the dimension of engagement, because I think the whole evangelical movement really stresses the personal relationship with God, and that would predict a very kind of engaged image of God, and that happens to be the case. Take, then, in comparison, a mainline Protestant, let's say a Presbyterian, they're much more evenly distributed across these different types of God, as are Roman Catholics. So what that means is, if you picked a Roman Catholic kind of at random, I would have trouble predicting what image of God they have.
Mm-hmm.
They could be anything, really, and so you'd have to query them further. But evangelical Protestants, and especially black Protestants, you know, I would lay my money, if we picked one of them at random, they probably believe in an authoritative God, and if not that, a benevolent God. So the gods that are very engaged in the world.
One of the questions I want to ask to you, we just talked about Christian denominations here, and your survey is primarily geared toward Christians because it's the largest general grouping of religious mm-hmm. adherents in the country, but you do include in the survey a few others, and one of those are Jews. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. where do Jews fall along this 2x2 matrix?
Sure. There's a tendency for Jews to be more believers in a distant God, and also, very interesting, you have a substantial portion of them, probably 5%, that say they're atheists. Which on some level makes sense because, first of all, Judaism is sometimes thought of as kind of an ethnic identifier.
Right.
And so you're going to have people who are not, let's say, religiously active and clearly who say they're atheists who also still identify as Jews. Whereas if you look at the other religious categories, it's almost non-existent that you would have an atheist. Well, I don't think we had any atheists who say they were evangelical Protestants or were a member of a black Protestant church. So in that sense, Jews look very different in their images of God from American Christians. Much more likely to believe in a distant God, surprisingly, have quite a few atheists. And much less likely to believe in an authoritative God, for sure.
Yeah, I found that to be a really interesting aspect of the book. And again, you spend most of your time on Christian denominations, and so you don't explore this as much. But initially, when I was reading through the different categorizations, I said, well, you know, if you take Judaism, relying on the Old Testament, there's a lot of smiting and wrath in that book, burning bushes and such, engagement of God in the world. I would have probably thought that Jews would have fallen more into the authoritative category, but the fact that they fall into the distant category is I think, a topic worthy of future study in that regard.
Yeah, I know. That is really interesting. I mean, my own kind of sense of why that is that I think it's a religion that is often based on tradition and ritual, and also it has a kind of an ethnic element to it. And probably, again, I'm just kind of speaking off the cuff here, if you interviewed Jews, you would get a less of a sense of a literal translation of the Bible. Maybe they view kind of stories of the Old Testament as more metaphorical. I don't know. I mean, so that could possibly be an explanation.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too. And I think about that in terms of Christianity, and you bring this out in the book, is that the Old Testament is filled with lots of smiting and vengeful wrath and such. But the New Testament tends to emphasize this more loving, caring God. Mm-hmm. And so in Christianity, you see this mixed up quite a bit. And we're talking about denominations, and this should be pointed out to our listeners, that it's not a one-to-one correlation with the denomination. So if you're an evangelical Protestant, it does not necessarily mean that you're authoritative. Mm-hmm. One of the more interesting aspects that comes out in the qualitative aspect of your book was when you actually went to a specific church and tried to find out what the different visions or concepts of God were within this church. And it's a great example, because the church that you chose to do this is a fairly isolated church. So it's a very tight-knit mm-hmm. community, and the expectation would be that everybody in that church is going to be thinking the same. So tell us a little bit more what you found in that rural Texas church.
Sure, sure. So we went to this really pretty conservative evangelical church in the hinterlands of Texas, that it was very difficult to even get there. And it was a very vibrant, active church, lots of members, but they kind of fit maybe a cliché notion people would have in their heads of rural Texans, right? Cowboy hat-wearing, cowboy boot-wearing people. And very tight-knit church. People knew each other there for a long period of time. And so one of the things we found when we started to interview people at this church is, you know, they agreed on a lot of things, as you would expect. But once we started to ask people about God and kind of more detailed theological questions, we found some disagreements going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, I mean, my interpretation of what was happening is that religious language is kind of mysterious in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You just take the word God, for instance. You know, people talk about God all the time, and maybe people are used to that, using that in their vocabulary. But when you really press them to say, well, how do you define this? You know, some people are kind of like, well, I have to kind of think about this a little bit more. And they also have to think about whether, when their preacher is telling a story, is he meaning this literally? Is he meaning this metaphorically? I mean, you could have very different interpretations of people sitting next to each other in the pew. And I think that is what came out when we started to talk to people at this small rural church, is they started to talk about how they viewed these things differently. And some people had fairly distant attitudes about God. Others, I'd say probably the majority, had a very authoritative God. And kind of in a humorous way, when I shared some of this data with the preacher later, he was kind of upset with this variation and wanted to nip it in the bud. So, he thought that he was going to be much more kind of forthright about explaining to people about how he thought they should imagine God.
Yeah, that's interesting. I reflected upon that when you mentioned that in the story, and I just think of that as us being professors, that we're up in front of class preaching our words, and you think that everybody sitting out there is hearing the exact same thing, but then when you give them a test or talk to them one-on-one, you say, that's what you got out of that? Well, that wasn't what I said. I don't think so. So, yeah.
You know, and I think in some sense the danger is even more with religious language.
Yeah.
Just because it's talking about things that are essentially undefinable on some level. One preacher we talked to said, we start the book with this quote, says, there aren't enough pages in the world to write a book about God.
Right.
And I think what he's saying is this topic is endless, and it has no, it's so deep that we can't really penetrate it. And so it would make sense that you get a lot of differences of opinion about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that there are a lot of these differences, even within a single isolated church, you still see some patterns in the data related to a variety of socio-demographic characteristics. And I'm just wondering if we could review some of those, such as gender, race, wealth. Let's go ahead and start with gender. Is there a difference between men and women when it comes to these conceptualizations?
Yes. Women are more likely to think of God as engaged. And have a very strong personal relationship with God. And men are more likely to think of God as judgmental. Now, why this is, we didn't really go into, but it kind of maybe fits expectations a little bit. If we think of women as being more concerned in relationships and I guess men might be more judgmental or authoritative. Who knows? But that clearly was a trend.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we look at race, I think the big finding there was that African Americans tended to be more likely to think of God as judgmental. It's not clear what's going on there. I think that's probably related to a certain extent to class, and what I mean by that is it's more likely that, or at least percentage-wise, African Americans tend to be disproportionately in lower class, and we find that people who have lower incomes are much more likely to think of God as judgmental. And one of the reasons we argue that probably logically makes sense is that, if you are living a life of hardship or feel disenfranchised in some ways, it would make sense that you would imagine that God would be upset about this state of affairs and maybe a little bit wrathful about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's some sort of logical explanation to that.
Yeah, it conforms with a lot of previous sociological thinking on this, and you're able to really explore this in that dimension. As you mentioned, too, some of these things that you find in the survey are interesting, haven't been fully explored yet, but that leaves a lot of room for graduate students and other scholars around the country to really kind of pick this apart and see what's going on. So there's a lot more research that can be done in that area. What about education levels?
Education is, very strongly, people with more education tend to think of God as less engaged with the world and less judgmental.
And then finally, the last one, and this I remember when your initial study came out about this, and I heard you talking on a local radio station out here in Seattle, and I said, hey, that's Paul, I know him. You talked about the regional differences, and again, we want to stress that there's not a one-to-one correlation here, that even within a denomination such as a small rural Texas church, there will be different conceptualizations, but there are tendencies in the country to favor one of these concepts over the other. And tell us about that.
I know it was interesting when we split the country into different regions. We essentially split it into four regions: East, West, Midwest, and South. And in each of these regions, a different God dominated the region in terms of the percentage of people who believed in that God. And so for the East, the dominant God was the critical God. And for the West, the dominant God was the distant God. The Midwest, it was the benevolent God. And for the South, it was the authoritative God,
mm-hmm.
Which was kind of interesting. Now, I mean, I can make up all kinds of stories why that would be, but I don't really know. I mean, the South maybe is considered the Bible Belt and clearly a very strong region with a lot of evangelical churches, so that would explain why you might have more engaged, more judgmental images of God. And the West is often considered less churched, so maybe that's why you'd have a stronger image of a distant God. But other than that, I mean, it's kind of an interesting relationship.
I think now I'm going to reveal what I did on the test. I took
it. Oh, cool.
And, you know, I am a male living out in the West and you know, high education and doing pretty well in terms of income and stuff. When I took this test, and again, for folks who are listening here, I just advise you to go out and take this on their website. I tended to fall into the authoritative category. And
okay.
It was interesting doing this because I had read the book first and I knew what the categories were and I knew, okay, you're a white male from the Pacific Northwest and this is the category you should fit in,
you're
Tony.
You're breaking the trends for sure.
Yeah, I am. And, you know, I kind of understood as well what the different dimensions really meant to all of this. And so it was very self-reflective to be looking at this survey, knowing the theories that were underlying this. I think I didn't have a chance to map everything out, but I think I also fell into the benevolent category as I was answering things. I knew a number of categories I would have been slotted down as the, you know, more caring, less judgmental God, and possibly in some cases less engaged in that. So I, if you had to map me out, I think it might be a little bit closer to the center, but I was kind of surprised to find out I was a little bit more on the authoritative category.
Oh, that is interesting. Well, and it's, I know, it's kind of interesting to take the survey yourself. And again, I mean, people who do it should obviously be aware of that this is not a hard and fast thing, that we're kind of revealing general trends and that we're never going to completely capture your individual sense of God simply because we definitely found this in talking to people about God across the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated. You know, it's very, very complicated. And people have very passionate, deep relationships with God. So clearly our little survey can't capture all of those things. But it is fun to do, and I think, kind of like what you said, it allows you to maybe ponder it a little bit and think about yourself a little bit more.
Well, let me ask you to go a little bit beyond the scope of the book, and I know this is not what you do in the book, nor what the data really might be allow you to do.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was taking this, I was thinking about, well, I shift around a lot. I mean, on any given day, if you came up and asked me, I might be in my distant God mood, saying, oh, you know, God set the clock, the watchmaker, and everything is running as it is. Other days, I might see a more benevolent God. Things are going swell for me, and I just think God's blessing is on me. I see some rainbows and you know, rabbits dancing outside. So to what extent do you think, and again, I'm going to excuse you because this is not exactly what you do in your book, but to what extent do you think these are fluid for individuals?
I think, you know, as you point out, we don't have the longitudinal data to look kind of if A, these images of God change over the life course, and then B, kind of your more specific question, do they change over the hours of the day?
Mm.
I think on some level they must, right? Because let me actually draw an analogy to maybe point this out. It's kind of like how people feel about their spouse. You know, at one minute of the day, you're going to be irritated. At another minute of the day, you're going to be extremely happy. At another minute of the day, you're going to be proud. I mean, it's going to change, right? But I would argue that in general, people's attitudes of their spouse are probably, unless you're going through some horrendous divorce or something, they're going to be stable over definitely weeks and months and hopefully years. I think that's probably a good comparison to people's understanding, their image of God, their relationship with God. Clearly, there could be crises that shift it dramatically or huge revelations that change things. But on a day-to-day basis, sure, you're going to find these kind of fluctuations. But in general, I think if we ask people questions over the long haul, I would expect them to remain fairly stable. That's just my expectation, my prediction. I mean, does that make sense to you?
It does, and so that there's a range of this. And again, what your book does nicely, this is the first exploration in-depth of how people conceive God in a very empirical way, quantitatively and qualitatively. But it opens a lot of other questions. So how does this change? And so there's a huge research agenda that can come from this book. So one of the great things that I like about research is that it raises as many questions as it answers. And this is one of those books. So I urge
Just kind of make another point there. I mean, take the conception of, like, if you talk to somebody and you say, you know, does God love you? And they say, yes, God loves me. There could be times in that person's life when they're feeling unloved. But I think in general, that idea that there's a God and God is loving them is probably pretty stable, I would guess. Similarly, you know, do you think that God punishes the wicked? And somebody says yes to this. Again, there might be times when they see a wicked person that seemingly is not being punished, which throws that into doubt. But over the long course, they probably retain that general belief. And so in that sense, again, I would argue for the stability of much of this stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is this underlying stability to it, and it can waver in, you know, small ways over days or weeks or so. But I think they are fairly solid in setting the foundations for us. And speaking of that, since it does set the foundation, we talked about this early, that our images of God tend to be a very foundational aspect of our thinking of the world. The chapters in the book that follow your discussion of these four groups really talk about how these conceptualizations of God affect our thinking and our behavior and other aspects of life. And so let's talk about some of those areas. We probably won't get a chance to talk about all of them. But you start out in chapter 3 with God and morals. And this is the stuff that we typically think about when we think about the importance of religion or cultural issues such as abortion, gay marriage, adultery, premarital sex, and stem cell research you throw in there. So what can you tell us about how the four images of God break down here in determining the way people think about these quote-unquote cultural issues?
In this one, I mean, there are a couple of kind of, I think, interesting findings here. One is, well, first of all, how do you measure different attitudes about morals is kind of a research question. Mm-hmm. And the way we did it for this book was we tended to ask people about certain behaviors and to what extent were those behaviors wrong. So we were really looking at individual behaviors like adultery, you know, like stealing, these types of things, and ask people, is this behavior wrong all the time? Is it wrong just some of the time, or is it never wrong? And what this is picking up is a person's sense of moral absolutism or moral relativism. And so absolutism is whether you have a kind of a list of behaviors that are wrong all of the time.
Right.
That you are absolute about that. Versus some people think, well, you know, it all depends. It all depends on the situation, who's doing it, what's going on behind that. These are moral relativists. And what we find is that people who believe in more engaged and judgmental God, especially judgmental, mm-hmm. Tend to be moral absolutists. They think there's a list of things you cannot do. People who tend to have a more distant God tend to be more relativists. They think, well, it all depends. And they also believe that God is kind of a moral relativist in the sense that God understands the circumstances that are surrounding any behavior, and so God's kind of making that judgment too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how it fell out. One thing that was really interesting, though, is that, and I hope I can explain this clearly, is that in these kind of lists of behaviors we talked about, people of all God beliefs rank them the same way.
Right.
But they just differed on the extent to how absolute they thought a behavior was in terms of its wrongness or in terms of it being a sin or not.
You do. You have a great series of charts in the book that show the relative ranking of these is identical for all four of the groups, but each of them is just shifted down on this big, you know, absolutist versus relativist continuum that you have up there. So, you know, adultery is for all four groups considered a no-no, but it rates differently on the continuum for each of these different groups. And the same thing, I think abortion comes next, and it goes on down the list. So that is an absolutely fascinating finding. And it really, for me, brought home how useful these categories are for understanding behavior. Because we do see this underlying pattern that, yes, everybody thinks adultery is wrong, but according to these different views of God, you are more likely to be forgiving on some of these things than others.
Yeah. And you know, the same thing was true of the, you know, we asked about different situations in which somebody might have an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the exact same thing, is that people kind of ranked the situation. So, for instance, most people think if you're having an abortion just because it's inconvenient to you to have a child, that's wrong. But if you're having an abortion because it's threatening the danger of the mother, maybe that's okay. And so those rankings tended to be the same for every believer, but then again shifted for instance, the distant believer tend to think, well, you know, there are lots of reasons it could be okay to have an abortion, whereas the believer in the authoritative God say there's very few, but there are some situations where it's okay to have an abortion.
Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it for people to actually go investigate that in the book and see it for themselves, because they are incredibly revealing charts that you see the step process of how you move from mm-hmm. authority of God to
distant
God. Yeah,
it's kind of difficult to explain in words.
So we say, go out and buy the book. That's important.
Exactly.
Let me go to the next chapter, and this is an interesting one to me. It's the issue of God and science. Folks, I want to apologize. We had a small computer glitch here that disconnected us with Paul, but he is back on the line. We're talking now about the issue of God and science, which is chapter 4 in his book. And this is how people with different conceptualizations of God view the role of science in our society, perhaps the efficacy of science in solving our day-to-day problems, how much reliance we put upon the scientific method. And a lot of this goes back to the issue of creationism or intelligent design versus evolutionary theory. And in Texas recently, there was a large debate over textbooks on whether or not creation science or intelligent design should be put into textbooks alongside Darwinian evolutionary theory. And it's presented in the media in very stark ways. But when you take a look at the data and fit this into the four different conceptualizations of God that you identify that different people have, what do you find in terms of this God versus science debate?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting part of the book, and it really revealed something to me that I hadn't thought before. That is, first of all, religious believers tend overwhelmingly to think that science and their faith is fully compatible.
Mm-hmm.
That was somewhat surprising to me. The people most likely to think that science and faith are completely incompatible tend to be atheists. So that for believers, it's not so much that they think that science is against religion, but they might think that certain scientists or certain scientific theories aren't really accurately depicting reality. And this often happens for believers in a God that's more engaged with the world. Now, this makes some sort of logical sense, because if you believe that God is really fully engaged in the workings of the world and how things are proceeding, it would make sense that science should, on some level, be conscious of that.
Right.
And I think what happens is, for believers in a very engaged God, they tend to see scientists not talk about God, in fact, maybe even disparage discussions about God, and they think this is a scientific error, this is a mistake, because they view the cosmos as being guided by God, and so a science that is a real science and that's an accurate science should be aware of that.
Okay, let's move on now to the issue of God and Mammon, which you entitled Chapter 5 of your book. And this deals with different conceptualizations of God and how we view economic justice and social welfare provision. This one, I like this chapter a lot because it dealt with how African-American churches oftentimes view certain social issues. And for me, it's a very interesting topic because while many African-American churches have a very evangelical slant to them, they differ than a lot of the white evangelical churches on this issue of social justice. So what do you find in terms of the conceptualizations of God and the issues of economic justice?
This was a very difficult chapter to write, just simply because the topic was extremely complex. But let me see if I can boil down at least one kind of interesting point from the chapter, and that is, as you're talking about this, a lot of African-American churches that we were, you know, we did some qualitative work in African-American churches, and also our survey data told us that people in black churches tended to believe in a very authoritative God. This is also true of a lot of white evangelical churches.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference. A lot of African-American churches are, they tend to be populated by Democrats and tend also to be very involved in social justice issues at the community level.
Right.
This made some interesting bedfellows, especially at the time that we were doing the research, was kind of at the end of the Bush administration, and the Bush administration was known for developing the faith-based initiatives. And so what they wanted to do was give some government money to churches to help serve their communities. Interestingly enough, it tended to be African-American churches that tended to vote Democrat made the most use out of this program. So it was a program that came out of a Republican administration, but then became utilized by African-American churches serving their communities. And I think what brought these two different groups that you would think were somewhat in conflict together was a shared image of God, that God is active in the world and can have a role in bringing about social change.
That I found that to be a rather interesting chapter. Again, we had recent podcasts on this faith-based initiative with Jay Hine. We'll link up to that, as well as discussions of the African-American church with Marissa Davis. So we'll link up to those ones as well.
Oh, neat.
Mm-hmm. You're saying?
I'm just saying that's great. That's great. And in fact, we interviewed Jay Hine for the book, so that's a nice segue.
I know that he was in there. What does this tell us also about political affiliations? Is there a relationship between the different type of God that you conceive of and how you vote at the ballot box?
Again, this isn't a perfect correlation, and African-American churches definitely buck this trend. But it tends to be people who believe in more engaged, more judgmental gods. So these are people who tend to believe in authoritative God, also benevolent God, tend to be more conservative and tend to vote Republican, whereas people who believe in the more distant God tend to be liberal and vote Democrat. So there is a clear relationship there.
You take this in your book, in one of the last chapters, to look at how people view specific policy areas. And you title this chapter Dealing with Good and Evil. And one could see how these two major dimensions of your categorization really play out here, the issues of engagement and judgmental. You know, obviously those who show or who share the authoritative and critical versions of God would see God playing a bigger role in how we view evil in the world, including belief in Satan there as well. You also expand in this chapter about how we view bad things happening to good people, the disasters, for instance, and how this stuff plays out. But the most intriguing aspect of that chapter was really how we thought about some foreign policy issues and the war in Iraq. What did you find out in terms of people's conceptualization of God and how they viewed America's mission of smiting evil elsewhere out in the world?
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, this relates back to the chapter about God and morals, and that is, people with more authoritative images of a God tend to be moral absolutists. And so they have much more a conception of things are good or they're bad. And this then relates to, in terms of foreign policy or in terms of public policy, that there are definite individuals or groups that we could define as evil. In other words, they are doing bad things in the world. And clearly, terrorists would fit that definition. Whereas people with more kind of distant images of a God, they don't like the language of good versus evil or even defining certain groups as evil. They want to think in terms of more the circumstances that are leading people to making, let's say, bad decisions. So that when an administration is pitching a foreign policy or even a national policy to the public, I think politicians that talk in terms of good versus evil, and clearly President Bush did when fighting terrorism, talked about evildoers, talked about the axis of evil, that language is much more appealing to believers in authoritative God. It fits that general worldview. And so, and it really defines for us who and where evil is in the world. And so they're much more supportive of military action that is attacking evil, whereas people who believe in a more distant God don't like that kind of language. And if you look at then, let's say, compare President Bush's rhetoric to President Obama's rhetoric, you don't hear Obama talking about evil. You don't hear him talking about evildoers. And so in this sense, his foreign policy is going to be less understood, let's say, by believers in authoritative God. And maybe his language is more appealing to believers in a distant God.
And this plays out really interesting in terms of disasters, natural disasters or man-made disasters as well. And you point out this in various parts of the chapter, such controversial statements by, say, Pat Robertson when Hurricane Katrina rolls into New Orleans or when the Twin Towers on 9/11 are knocked down, that many people who share the authoritative God vision of the world see this as punishment for some evil doing that the United States has done. We've fallen from grace in terms of cultural corruption and what we watch on television, the violence and sex and stuff. And those views of disasters are really filtered through that authoritative vision of the world. Is that what you found?
Yeah. And anytime you have something like that, say New Orleans, the hurricane that hit New Orleans, or the 9/11, it's going to confuse us all. And we're all going to try to make sense of this. And this kind of goes back to the basic theme of the book, is faced with kind of confusions or inconsistencies, people are going to start to rely on their image of God to make sense of the world. And so people who think of God as judgmental and very engaged are very confused, let's say, by 9/11. What does this mean for them? They start to think about why did God allow this? Is God sending us a message? And then if you have kind of public elites, like, let's say, a Pat Robertson, who starts to try to make sense of it in certain ways, like saying, well, maybe God is punishing us for homosexuality or punishing us for loose morals in the United States, that is going to make sense to a lot of those believers. Whereas a person who believes in a more distant God is not going to be convinced by that kind of answer, because it doesn't fit with their image of God at all. So in that sense, it's people struggling to make sense of a complicated world. And what kinds of explanations we're given make sense to us, I think, goes back to the type of God that we imagine.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to wrap up our podcast here, that these conceptualizations that we have of God are very important, and you've put your finger on identifying how we view our gods, or how we view God and throughout the United States here, and how that impacts our other aspects of our daily life. You do a number of other excellent things in this book, including, you know, talking about the good and evil. You do a number of qualitative studies, as we mentioned. One of those was going to the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, to really see how this stuff plays out. And your description of that and your discussion of that, I find absolutely fascinating. But with limited amount of time here, we're just going to have to ask people to pick up a copy of the book. We'll link to it on our website, as well as the website that you have published for this book as well. Paul, I want to thank you very much for being on the podcast today, and I'm sure a lot of people will get a lot of stuff out of this book, and I urge you to go buy it. So again, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and it was a lot of fun chatting with you.
It was great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.